My guest today is Raymond Mathoda, Chief Executive Officer of Anchor Loans. A Princeton graduate with an MBA from Kellogg School of Management, Raymond has more than 25 years of experience across the real estate, finance, and technology sectors, and has a track record of delivering transformational growth and value creation. Raymond has been an investor in a number of co-founded startups focused on expanding access to novel, genomic, and therapeutic products in emerging markets, including India and Asia. Raymond serves as a chairperson of the board at Desi Rainbow Parents and Allies, a large nonprofit serving South Asian LGBTQ families and persons in the US. Without further ado, let's just jump into understanding Raymond's journey. Thank you so much for being my guest on Atlanta Diaries, Raymond.
It's my pleasure to be here, Anma. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So with the breadth of experience in various sectors, including fintech, biotech, real estate, and mergers and acquisitions, love to hear from you and your brief overview of your journey. I think you'll be the best person to give us a snapshot.
Delighted to share the journey. Let's take it back to where it all started. I was born and brought up in India, mostly in the north. My dad used to work for the so-called dreaded Indian IRS. And so he was a public servant. But there were about 40 to 45 doctors in my family because my great-grandfather from Punjab was a school teacher who realized the value of education and educated all of his children, my grandfather and his three sisters, so much so that the three sisters became doctors. And from there, they gave birth to doctors and those doctors married doctors and all of this proliferated. And it was clear that sort of the path in my family was that I either become a doctor or an engineer, like my father and his brother who had gone to IIT. Now, I would say my father was a very forward-thinking, progressive, contrarian guy. He said, I don't need you to come first in your class. Just make sure that you focus on understanding the principles that they are teaching you and try to be in the top 10%. So the pressure was off. At some point, he started to expose us to things like the Delhi Golf Club, where we would go swimming and also play golf. Swimming was an unconventional choice. People in India at the time, this is the 80s, didn't throw their kids into sports. But I really took a liking to swimming. And magically, at sort of 9 years old, I happened to be in the modern school in Delhi. And it turned out that the modern school actually had an Olympic-sized pool. And so I ended up representing my school and basically becoming Delhi state champion. And that led to a journey of being a well-rounded person. A couple of other things. In 1984, the Sikh riots happened. These two guys got upset that Indira Gandhi had made the army go into the Golden Temple and they shot her. And a very unfortunate series of events unfolded from there, which felt like retribution to the entire Sikh community in the north. I felt that sense of danger. We experienced, you know, something like 20,000 Sikhs being slaughtered by hand. We had to wipe our name off the front of our house. Thankfully, we were in defense colony where our neighbors were very supportive. And I had a very interesting experience where, you know, guns are very hard to get permitted in India. But I happened to grow up in a house that at the time had several licensed guns. And so we cut off my brother's hair and we had that conversation that if a mob came and attacked us, we would defend ourselves as the Sikhs have done many times over the course of their history and potentially die if we had to. So I would say that experience left a very big imprint on my mind. It really was an understanding at 9 years old that society doesn't work as it's supposed to. The political parties and leaders are not always doing what is right. And given the Sikh ethos of seva and defending the weak against the strong, my conclusion was that my life's purpose should be to make the world a better place. I also needed to be strong and have support to be safe in life. And again, I give this back to my dad. My dad and I would take these long walks around Defense Colony and talk about entrepreneurship, capitalism, money. How do you create more money and value? And really, my agenda was to study capitalism, study economics, go get a master's degree like every good Indian does, and go back and get married to one of Punjab's top families, probably do business for a while because without wealth, it's very difficult to have power. And then my agenda was to go into politics because I had seen politics go very, very wrong in 1984. And I wanted to be an agent for change. So that was sort of the story and how it all started.
This is great. let's segue into the professional journey a little bit and how you deliberated on your career path, particularly transitioning from the for-profit to social entrepreneurship.
So when I was graduating from Princeton, I thought I would work here for a couple of years, go get an MBA and then go home. I applied to a bunch of jobs and got a job at McKinsey, Los Angeles, and came here to LA in 1996. And within the first 6 months, I met this woman, and very quickly thereafter, we fell in love. I'm 22 years old. And at the same time, I was excelling at McKinsey. Then I went to Northwestern to get my MBA as I had planned. The beauty of McKinsey is you start working on the most important questions with the most important people at a company when you're very, very young. And so here I got an entree at a pretty high level and got a lot of exposure to both tech as well as healthcare. And so I became sort of a co-leader of the McKinsey West Coast healthcare practice and thought I would go on the track and maybe become a partner. And life took a turn when one of my best friends from Kellogg, Northwestern, actually died in a freak accident in Brazil. And so his funeral ended up being on the same day as a meeting with the CEO of the second largest hospital system in the US, where I was leading projects to go turn around and transform hospitals. I reached out to a senior partner. I said, what do you think I should do? I was supposed to make associate principal. So some of these meetings and showing up and, you know, demonstrating what you can do is kind of how you get recognition. He put pressure on me to go to the meeting instead of going to the funeral. So I went to the meeting. Then I came home. I sat down and I thought about what I had done. I had picked my career over one of my dearest friends. And I decided at that moment that that's not the person I want to be. And I don't blame McKinsey for it, but I blamed myself. I basically said, you know what, if this environment made me make this choice, I choose not to be a part of this environment. So I decided to leave McKinsey. I ended up getting into the housing sector. There was a McKinsey partner who had moved to this company, IndyMac, and he pulled me in because I had done a project that was very relevant to something that they wanted to do. And very interestingly, I had a meeting where the CEO saw me speak and make a presentation. And from that moment, he wanted me to work with him directly. He was sort of like this Caucasian, you know, maybe a little bit more conservative Republican CEO. And with my status as a brown Indian lesbian, I was a little bit worried about what our chemistry would be and how it would affect my career. So I remember throwing out a couple of references to LGBT, lesbian, and AV. And within a couple of minutes, he said, oh, I realize that you're LGBT and I want you to know I don't care one bit. I'm 100% supportive of LGBT people, 100% supportive of women, and I believe in meritocracy. And I would say that in the next 4 years, I ended up learning so much about the housing sector, working with Mike Perry. He made me his chief of staff. And so I got to really see how to scale a company from about 4,000 people to about 10,000 people. And then on the back end, I became a part of that great recession and the housing market and got to really experience that firsthand. And again, going back to my father, the ethos in the family was keep your needs simple and you won't have stress in life. The key in life is to keep your independence. Be strong. Don't work for somebody forever. And so when the Great Recession happened, I decided because I'd had the opportunity to go to Princeton for free, essentially, I had a full scholarship. And then McKinsey reimbursed or paid for Kellogg as long as I came back to McKinsey for 2 years after business school. As you know, my father didn't make very much money. He was a public servant in India. And yet I had been able to have this incredible education and opportunity. And now at IndyMac, I had risen up to be one of the top 10 people. So I felt a great sense of privilege and also obligation to America, which had provided me a safe and nurturing environment to grow. And so I basically resigned from my job and I decided I'm going to go do whatever it takes to make a difference to help the nation recover from the crisis. So I spent about 4 years just working for the benefit of the country because of my background as a Sikh. And at that point, AV and I tried for one kid and we got a set of twins in 2010. And then we tried for one more kid and we got another set of twins. So at that point, the financial pressures on me became immense. And frankly, I became a little bit skeptical of my work in the public sector and the real opportunity to impact things. I had this sort of view that we should create millions of units of affordable housing in single family form. Dramatic opportunity for this country to expand affordable housing. But it was never even the subject of a serious conversation. It was too radical of an idea. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to work at this intersection and try to look for businesses that are creating good in the world, but that are doing it through a capitalistic method, a profit purpose, And that can be scalable. I also realized I needed to make a certain amount of money to protect my family, because at that point, neither AV nor I had any substantial family support, certainly no financial support. So I basically became what I would call a hired gun CEO. I would get found by these entrepreneurs who had either stuck or underperforming companies, and I would help them go fix that, create value, and take a piece of that value. And so I did 5 turnarounds or fixers between 2012 and 2020, ended up securing my family. And that brings us close to where we are today.
This was amazing. And of course, many, many questions came to my mind. Raymond, that looks like you had a very special relationship with your dad. You also talked about the fact that you wanted to go back to politics and you wanted to go back to India. What caused you to change course and decide to settle in America?
I decided to settle in America because once I came out as LGBT, I did not feel safe going to India anymore. Unfortunately, and I blame the British for this, because they brought in all these anti-sodomy laws and all this stuff that's homophobic. Even though our religions and our faith and our history demonstrates a much bigger openness to both gender diversity as well as sexuality diversity. There are images of same-sex lovers on temple walls. There are stories of even Lord Vishnu changing from a man to a woman. What is that if that's not transgender? And then having a baby who becomes a famous god in the South, Lord Ayappa. And so, to be blunt about it, it was illegal to be gay in India until 2018. The truth is, in 2000, when I came out and when my career was starting out, I literally did not even feel physically safe. I knew that there was no way I could have a family in India. I did not feel safe going with Avantika and living in India. And I certainly did not think I could have anything close to a business or political career that would prosper. The only way any of that would be possible is if I was silent and I lied about who I am. And if I changed my identity and went and married somebody that was credible and took that track. And because I had decided, partly rooted in my religion, to live the Satnam word that gets repeated so much, truth is God, truth is his name, truth is life, I decided to follow my truth, and I could only follow my truth in the US. And so then I became a naturalized citizen of America and decided to build a life here. But I still have this big emotional tie to India. I love India. I love Indians. I love our culture. And I wanted to make a contribution to my motherland. And so I decided to make that contribution through these purpose-driven businesses. I teamed up with a couple of entrepreneurs that I knew to try to do what we call biotech for poor people. You know, biotech innovation done at a radically lower price and cost, so that you could profitably sell things at a lower cost to people who could afford them. And so that was sort of the arc that my life ended up taking from that point on.
Wow. You were an overachiever, you know, in a sense, a perfect child, right? What were then your apprehensions to come out to your family so late?
Yeah. No, it's so true. It's a really interesting question, because my family had been very progressive until the time that I came out. And actually, I would tell you, I thought they would accept me much earlier than they actually did. My apprehension was just rooted in the energy around my relationship with AV. They did not want me to be close to AV. So there was already a dynamic force trying to shift the level of closeness to AV and get her away from me. And then the other thing I would say is that any LGBT comments that had been made in my presence growing up had been very homophobic, had been very stigmatized. It was sort of like the hush-hush gossip of, oh my God, so-and-so's son is gay and he's got AIDS. And then the other thing is, I would tell you, there were no LGBT people represented in the Indian population in India, or frankly, in the diaspora at that time. There was literally only one gay individual I knew about, who was the famous designer Rohit Bal.
Yeah.
And he was sort of viewed as this outlier. Oh, this fashion designer who's gay. So it was pretty clear from my upbringing, despite the progressiveness, that this was going to be a very unusual choice. They were introducing me to these Sikh boys from these good families to go have that arranged marriage. And I didn't feel any chemistry or interest in any of these people. And so this is where my desires started to diverge from my family and what they had taught me. And that was something that I could intuitively feel, even though I came from a progressive family.
And when did you realize yourself, Raymond, that boys is not your thing?
I would say that it was an evolutionary process, you know, and given the way that a lot of us grew up in India in the 70s and 80s, like there was no dating for me.
Right.
So I thought there's not going to be a love, you know, I'll get married to somebody. So I just had this different perspective on my life where life was more about what I would accomplish and the way I would be. And I could still be happy. Look, my parents, they had an arranged marriage. They are happy. But when I came to Princeton and started to be exposed to people from different walks of life, LGBT people, various groups and marches and gatherings. The other thing I'd realized, I was always in love with the Indian heroine and the females. Starting literally from Sadhana to Madhuri Dixit, like a full-on major crush on Madhuri Dixit, right? So this was like anathema, right? This was a very radical choice and I didn't even think it was an option for me. But I remember thinking once at Princeton, could I be gay? Like I'm so attracted to that female energy. But I kind of swept it under the rug. And it wasn't until I would say I met AV and felt this like just crazy interest in this person that I started to think about my identity and what it could be and allowed myself to look into my own heart honestly to say, what am I? Could I be gay? And that was a journey in and of itself. It's interesting. One's own journey of understanding your identity and accepting yourself can sometimes be the most challenging. And I would say I started to think about it between 17 and 21 when I was at Princeton. I did not take any action. So first I thought that I've found my soulmate in female form. And then as I allowed myself to be exposed to other people and realize there are other people out there and this is like a real thing that happens in nature. And then I honestly started to think about it. And so that's how the story unfolded. Well into my mid-20s until I fully accepted myself, I would say.
Yeah, what I was hearing was from denial to acceptance and then embracing.
Yes, exactly. Very much so. But it was a tough journey because the reaction of the parents to the coming out was extraordinarily negative, way more negative than I expected. And so that started a very, very difficult journey, where my truth became so in conflict with the happiness of my family and loved ones that it makes it very hard to accept yourself and to be okay with yourself as you proceed.
How did you try to make it work?
I would say that I super fumbled out the coming out process. I made the mistake of not meeting other people who were LGBT before coming out. I thought I should tell my parents first, you know, this sort of like sense of loyalty. I didn't do my research on how you're supposed to come out. I really fumbled it. I just told my parents over email.
Oh my God.
I don't know if I would have honestly had a better reaction in person, but certainly coming out on email with no heads up, I think was the wrong way to do it. I fell into a depression because of the lack of acceptance and the negative energy and the lot of pain coming from my parents because, you know, Indian parents live through their children.
Yeah.
They say you're supposed to release your child and they're supposed to live their own life. But the truth is, in India, until economic liberalization, and even I would say until relatively recently, people have not had the opportunity to live their dreams. And so in a way, people make a lot of sacrifice to live their dreams through their children. But that creates a very unhealthy dynamic where now the child is becoming a representation of your desires instead of the child going out and pursuing their truth and living their best life. At some point, some of my friends had to say, what you are going through right now is very toxic for you, Raymond. You need to protect yourself. And it had to be my straight friends who told me that, not my LGBT friends, because they had more credibility in some ways. Because, you know, this was me separating in a way from my family that I was so in love with. And I would say deeply attached to, perhaps overly attached to. But it was a journey of kind of separating and realizing that that dynamic with the family, with the lack of acceptance and the blame game, was very, very negative. And I had to protect myself. And, you know, I'll talk about my dad again. He's such a strong guy. Very, very strong guy. And I was kind of taught to always stand up for what's right. And so that gave me the strength to make it through. McKinsey was a very supportive environment. And I had a lot of support from my colleagues, as well as the friends that we came out to. And of course, 99% of them said, okay, so what? Of course, we already know. We totally support you.
Right.
So, you know, the younger generation and the friends, I would say, helped carry us through the journey and support us through the journey to be where we are today. And I would say the notion that I was now financially independent that was a crucial part of it too, because if you're financially dependent on your parents, you can't make it work.
Yeah.
And so it was a very arduous and painful journey. One that I would say has taken me 20 years to actually psychologically process, including with therapy, to come to a place where I feel very peaceful. And my own parents and family have gone through a journey of acceptance relatively recently, I would say, and have come to a place of peace about it. And I think the shifts in Indian society and in global society, the increasing acceptance of LGBT individuals across the world, gay marriage being accepted in America and many parts of the world, including South Africa, and then the 2018 judgment, which even the Indians are now clearly saying, Supreme Court of India, everyone in India, you have to accept your LGBT people. You may not be violent against them, which is a lot of what happened. People are physically or emotionally violent with their LGBT people to keep them quiet because they think it is dishonorable and disrespectful and ruins their reputation. And I would say there's probably few people who are as passionate as those of us that have found a safe place and a place to thrive here as a first generation immigrant. And so now I feel a great sense of belonging and a sense that I have to give back to this country that has given me this family, frankly, that I couldn't have had in India.
Thank you so much for sharing this, Raymond. You sound so positive and strong that it's hard to imagine that you went through such a tough 20 years. So if you had to label the emotion, was it anger or was it frustration with your parents? Like you said, it's all about perspectives. Was it empathy which worked to, you know, make peace, or was it some other perspective which worked for you?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It was all of those emotions. Frankly, the first part of it was denial. I just simply couldn't believe that I was not accepted by those most important to me. And you know what happened? I realized in 2020, 20 years after coming out, that I was having the same emotions over the whole 20-year horizon. And by the way, this is a well-known phenomenon in both meditation, mindfulness, Buddhism, as well as the Western approaches. And it was only COVID when I had this sense of space that I was able to go on these daily walks. And after a while, I realized I'm having the same thought pattern and the same sense of emotions. And then I realized, oh, that means I haven't processed this. I haven't moved beyond this. I haven't digested this. And so, you know, it went through all of the anger, denial, all of those five stages of acceptance. And so I think it really honestly was, you know, me going through a combination of Eastern and Western mindfulness, meditation, combined with psychotherapy to accept my reality as it is, to accept my parents as they are. They are limited by their own experiences and they've done the best they could. And so I think it was really the process of me working to accept them for who they are and to move beyond it, to go through a series of conversations with them through an intermediary where I realized they're never going to accept me as I want to be accepted or my family as I want to be accepted. So crazily enough, it was the notion of accepting them just as they are that ultimately led to them reaching a certain greater level of acceptance, because I did keep supporting them through it all. So my mom goes through some health challenges and has been going through it for the last several years. And one of the things that has been steady, regardless of whether we're even speaking to each other, which we've had periods where we didn't speak to each other, is I did keep that support steady through it all. Because of course, my parents are some of the most important people in the world to me. And they gave me so much growing up. And I think that sense of acceptance in the world and sort of the environment finally brought us to a place where things just started to get a lot better all around.
You took control, basically, totally.
And realized that something needed to be done. And by the way, that can be true of any kind of trauma in your life.
This was really powerful. And kudos to you and Avantika to make this so beautiful. Let's shift gears and talk about your marriage to Avantika. So how did you support her in her professional journey? What kind of challenges did you both go through as you built this institution of marriage?
Sure. So, you know, we knew we wanted to be with each other forever. And it was only that degree of love and commitment that prompted us to come out. So the first struggle was the struggle for rights. And this was before gay marriage was legal in America. So first we went and got a domestic partnership in the city of West Hollywood, which was the LGBT friendly area in Los Angeles. Then we realized, oh, the West Hollywood domestic partnership doesn't work for the state of California. So then we went and got another domestic partnership in the state of California. Then in 2004, Gavin Newsom, the then mayor of San Francisco, declared the anti-gay marriage law in California unconstitutional and said, okay, we'll marry you. Come to City Hall in San Francisco. So we jumped in a car and we went to City Hall and stood outside in lines for hours and hours, and we got married. A few months later, we got an annulment. Those marriages did not have legal standing. I always wanted kids, and we did want to try to have our kids within the institution of marriage because we wanted the kids to feel normal. And so we kept attempting marriage, and I was involved with the LA LGBT Center as a board member and sort of got involved in the, I'll call it LGBT movement for acceptance and equality. Finally, in 2008, when the California Supreme Court struck down that law that Gavin Newsom had declared unconstitutional, we got a window of an opportunity to get an actual legal, constitutionally viable marriage. And so we had that marriage in our backyard. Our brothers were there. Parents were not there. We were still scared to tell our parents 8 years after coming out. But we had this beautiful small wedding. And that then became the basis for what we had to build later. Now, career-wise, when I met AV, she was getting a master's in architecture at UCLA. She's a brilliant designer and a master's in virtual architect. So she was and one of the first people involved in building 3D architectural models. And then eventually she got into the world because it paid better, frankly. And she transitioned from architecture into that. And then eventually we decided, because it was so painful to be part of the software company with an H-1B, we decided that she should. And this was, by the way, maybe not the best decision because she's not a salesperson. She's much more of a creative force and energy. We decided she would open a real estate brokerage. She supported me when I was at school. I wasn't making money. She supported me, and we've supported each other. And we've sort of never viewed our money as separate, so to speak. It's always been a combined entity. She was intensely professional during the Great Recession, doing a lot of real estate work and worked through the first set of twins, partly because I wasn't making any money. Remember, I had become the social entrepreneur working for America for free for 4 years. So she supported us through that entire 4 year period. And I did some consulting work and brought in some income as well. But then once she got pregnant with the second set of twins, and we knew we would have four babies below 3 years old with no support, no nannies around, no dadis, nobody around, we decided that I needed to click into gear because I have this kind of capitalistic business career where I have the ability to make larger amounts of cash than are even possible in kind of real estate brokerage, etc. So that's where we said we probably have to go into a divide and conquer now. So she kept her practice going actually for many more years, but sort of downscaled it. And that's what led me to a very high motivation level. I really believe that we become the most successful when we have no other choice. It has to be done for survival. And then after a period of time, we decided that she would stop selling real estate. And she started to work actually on our family's real estate portfolio. And so she did a renovation for us and loved it. I'd never seen her that excited. Like, I have no interest in going out and looking for materials and what they could look like and doing that research. And this person really enjoys that. She's building us a house right now, actually, which should be really interesting once it's done, because it's supposed to be this sort of modern Indian courtyard house, you know, around that courtyard design where traditional Indian families used to live.
Yep.
With the social space in the middle and the family living around it. I always wanted to have one of those homes. And so she's then moved off into really the primary caregiver role. But four children need a lot of first physical attention, then emotional attention. And we both decided we want to be very hands-on parents and we want to be very close with our children. So that's sort of been the confluence and the partnership from a career standpoint.
Awesome. If I had to backtrack, you talked about significant losses you made during your time at Indymac, right? Some blunders in that journey. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. So one of the things that I've realized I've done a couple of times, leaving McKinsey, leaving Indymac, is I made a very quick decision to leave a place I didn't think was going in the right direction or was best for me. Suddenly I have a values clash at a moment in time. And instead of working it out, having the patience to stay and see how it goes, I opted out. I opted out of McKinsey, where I realized later on, there's just one guy who told me to do it. I could have gone to that funeral and I could have just stuck around. Maybe I would have become partner a year or two slower than I wanted to. There's this sort of artificial sense of urgency I think one has early in your career often, especially at these companies where it's like 5 to 7 years to partner, you feel you're on this deadline. I could have perhaps even become part of running the firm and transforming it in a direction that was more positive. than I felt that dynamic when I left. Same thing at IndyMac. I left very, very quickly because I thought the FDIC was maximizing the loss in the company instead of minimizing it. And I felt this deep sense of loyalty to the people who had created it. I made judgmental statements in my mind. I don't want to work with the vulture investors who come in to take this company, even if there's money in it for me. Well, both of those decisions were split-second decisions made too quickly within 48 hours. You know, don't make a life decision within 48 hours, especially if it's giving up your source of earning. Maybe slow it down a little. So I would say I learned patience from some of the actions that I took. I was able to ultimately work through the loss of income and what happened and find other opportunities, but my life might have been, you know, less challenging, less stressful to get to the same end place if I had been a little bit more slow and calm about it. The second thing I would just point out is don't put your 401k into one stock. Maintain financial diversification, even if you feel very passionate about something. And I would say that I was too much all in just moving my chips into one table. And then that table collapsed and I was left with nothing. And so I think there's a journey around that. I also learned to be more careful about what I say to who. I would say things that were not politically palatable at certain moments in time, even if they were correct. And so one of the things I actually ended up doing was I started to speak less about my ideas and what I thought should happen publicly. I still speak about my journey and what I think is right, and especially this LGBT cause, and try to promote acceptance in our Desi community. And I speak certainly on professional occasions, but I speak less about things that are highly contrarian or could be politically sensitive. Again, going back a little bit to sort of the yogic way of thinking, if you can become a little bit more of an observer of your life rather than the protagonist, there's sort of the agent and then there's the observer. You can start to be a little bit more conscious of what is happening to you rather than just being in the moment. Oh, one of the mistakes I've made is I've trusted people too much. I've done multiple handshake deals, which have come to bite me. Because what I've realized is people will promise you something when they desperately need you. But then once you fix their business and it's making a lot of money, unless your deal was contractually written down in a way that is legally enforceable, people's memories change, their desires change. They don't want to give you as much as they gave you before. So I can see that I end up sort of having a honeymoon period at certain moments. And while you can enjoy that moment, I also have now the maturity to sort of take a step back and say, Ray, just know this is temporary. And so I've sort of observed that dynamic over a period of time. And don't take my own successes too seriously, candidly. Because, you know, as we know, the world keeps changing and we have our ups and we have our downs. And so don't take either of those, either the ups or the downs too seriously, because this too shall pass.
Talk to me a little bit about your mentorship journey in these years.
I just am so lucky that I've had a lot of support. I'm a big one who doesn't like the ego to believe all my success is because of me. Mm-hmm. I think part of understanding life is understanding the privilege that you had and the support that you had. And so my mentorship started, I would say, with my grandfather, who mentored me into what it means to be a Sikh, even though we didn't go to the temple very much. The ethos in my life is very culturally Sikh. And by the way, the Sikh community is one of the worst on LGBT acceptance. So I'm pretty sad and upset at my faith and culture and the way it's evolved. I think it's come very far away from what the gurus intended it to be and what the book says it should be. You talked about my father. He was a great mentor of mine in my early days. Some of my swim coaches were mentors. I'm a big reader, by the way, so I can learn and I like to learn from the journeys of those that have gone before me. And so in some ways, the Sikh gurus and the way that they acted, they are my mentors. I think about that. And then later on in life, I've had the privilege of mentorship at McKinsey. And, you know, I was telling somebody the other day, I may be this brown Indian lesbian, but I don't fit easily into a box. Some of my best mentors have been white Republican CEOs. And it's true. Mike Perry at IndyMac was one of my great mentors and supporters who raised me up and made me a very senior individual at his company. I've had friends who've been mentors. I have had business partners who've been mentors, including some of the people that I ended up having disagreement with over time on the deal, which was not properly papered, for instance. And I would even say Avi's Nani is my mentor through her courage and the way she lives her life. even to this day, by the way, living alone in Palampur at 95 years old, of course, she has a helper now. But the way she conducts her life, the way she thinks, she's still learning, listening to podcasts, watching the news, and not stuck in an old way of thinking. And I try to give back by being a mentor, especially to women, because I feel like women perhaps don't give other women as much mentorship as they could. And maybe because that's even the senior women have this sort of little bit of a scarcity mindset where they don't have a sense of belonging that they can mentor. This is changing, by the way, and there's lots of women trying to mentor other women. But I try to mentor and support, especially those that lack that, whether it be LGBT individuals, individuals who come from families where they didn't have the context of career success. They came from a poor family where people worked in restaurants instead of a rich family where people were all doctors, lawyers, engineers. Yeah, that's sort of been the mentorship journey, so to speak.
Fascinating. You know, Ray, I want to just double click on your relationship with Mike Perry. You found indirect ways of letting him know that you're lesbian. What if he wasn't pro? Or what if he didn't put it out there saying, I'm all about meritocracy? Would that have changed the dynamic of your relationship with him?
I would not have taken the job with him. And he wanted me to become his chief of staff, which means he has an extraordinary influence on my career. And so I was floating that boat to make sure I was in a place where I could thrive. And if I had heard a bit more homophobia or a lack of response, I would have been much more reluctant to take the risk, this chief of staff type job, which has a very high variability of success. And I would say one of the learnings that I have that he taught me, interestingly, is, or clarified for me, and like, I'm a big believer, if you don't have the right company environment or the right boss who's going to support your development, you should leave and find one who does. And so that would have been my orientation. I was already in a company that I didn't expect to be at. I thought I would be in tech or healthcare. And here I'm sitting at a housing company, a mortgage lender. And so that could have affected my arc pretty substantially. It didn't, but it could have affected my arc fairly substantially. I might have even left the industry over time. So, yeah.
So, you know, someone who's so involved with the Desi Rainbows and even organization like Satrang, what are your fears or concerns? What do you aspire for the cause?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I am the board chairperson for Desi Rainbow Parents and Allies. And the whole thesis of this is that while there are organizations like Satrang and others, they're all local, small nonprofits that support LGBT youth and people. They create a safe space for people. What we realized is nobody's helping our moms and dads and dadis and nanas and grandparents and uncles and aunts. And yet the whole experience of an LGBT person who comes out is determined by what those people think and how they evolve. And so Desi Rainbow actually supports those people. We support the youth as well. But our primary focus on a national, across the US basis, is we work to help those parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, dads, moms, get the support from other people from their own culture. It turns out that good Jews want to talk to good Jews who have accepted. That is the best path for them to feel they are understood and to possibly then start to open up their minds. So I love the work that I do at all levels, and I view it as sort of part of my seva to the world. My fear is that the pace of change on LGBT acceptance for our kids is too slow. And so on the one hand, the eldest person in a family determines the fate of that LGBT person. So often it's a much older person. And my fear is that those people won't shift their mindsets and we won't make progress in India for another 25 or 50 years until those people pass away and the youth of India who are growing up in a different environment grow older. The desire then would be to change that and to accelerate that and to both support people, but to also create awareness, to expand education and to influence people through the right mechanisms, including media. There's a huge percentage of the population, 5 or 10%, maybe more, by the way, that is diverse on either gender or sexuality. And this is just normal human variation. And all of those people deserve to live their best life too. For instance, 50% of all transgender kids attempt suicide because they don't think they can ever have the life that they really want. And so the fear is that that pain and violence, emotional or physical, will continue to happen, or that we won't get gay marriage. There are very powerful people in India right now arguing against gay marriage, all for the wrong reasons, in my view. And so the goal and the hope is that progress is much faster, that the Indian Supreme Court accepts gay marriage and allows LGBT people to get married to the person that they want and to have safety, security in that relationship and to be able to build families and to accelerate progress so we can have less pain and more acceptance. And I think we can thrive better as society if all of those people can give their best contributions to our communities and societies.
Any parting thoughts for aspiring leaders as they transition into entrepreneurial roles or larger leadership roles?
You know, my only advice to people would be practical. Don't be so drunk on your ideas that you don't listen to all the other views on something. Pursue your idea or your passion, but realize that failure is on the path to success. And so I think this embracing of failure as a way to learn and iterate and sort of adopting that growth mindset instead of a fixed mindset. It's not about talent. It's more about work ethic, learning from failure and continuously iterating toward your goal. If you relentlessly pursue your goal over a long period of time, there is no doubt in my mind, everybody can achieve their goal. So that would be my parting thought.
Thank you, Raymond. Thank you very much for this conversation. And I really appreciate your partnering with me in this journey.
You're so very welcome, Emma. Thank you so much for all you do.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.